a history of the universe and noise. So is it, did we just hear ancient sounds?
So this one, I was just having a conversation with someone I worked with last year, actually, which I was recording. She's called Manas Rubash. And I was recording her, an interview of her to do as one of my sound diaries. And she works a lot with graphs and moved into sound a bit later. But I did three audio visual pieces for this show. And then I did also an installation piece. And for the three physical pieces that were hung in the gallery, I wanted to focus on working with different types of data and presenting them in different ways. So I had one piece called Solar Maximum, which mapped all the sunspots that had occurred in my life. And that was very quantitative. So I presented that more as a kind of a graph. And the because it was a very steady time period that I was taking this data, I was able to make quite a rhythmical piece of music around that.
How often are there sunspots?
Well, they happen at any period of time, but the data set they had was from a European agency, and they'd taken these sunspots every week. So they had just collated their weekly findings, and they said this week there's this amount of sunspots. So it wasn't a super complex grouping of information, but I found that interesting for that piece. And then I worked on a very abstract kind of conceptual art style piece, which was the history of the universe in noise, where I basically looked at the cosmic microwave background and was really interested in the fact that there's this huge signal that originated, I mean, essentially at the Big Bang. If the Big Bang happened, there's this big amount of radiation that occurs, and that's the background hiss that we can all hear. And I was interested in this thing called generation loss, which is when repeat copies of a piece of information just degrade in quality. So I created digital generation loss and also physical. So I basically built a piece of software that took files and then saved them over and over again until they had lost all their quality. And then I, for the physical version of that, I did re-recordings kind of like Alvin Lucier. But also for the visual element, I took pictures of the CMB, cosmic microwave background, and just scanned and rescanned them until they again were just noise.
So you're sitting in a room with a planet.
Yeah, I was interested in the conceptual. For that piece, I was interested in kind of explaining how I saw that scientific phenomena through conceptual art. And then the third piece I installed was called Gravity Waves. And that one kind of combined conceptual and actual data together. So I created this this simulation of two black holes colliding, which is what created the gravitational signal that was picked up about 2 years or so ago. And I created numerous visualizations and simulations of this. And then I used these simulations to control data sets and sounds that I'd taken from the place that had recorded it. It's called LIGO, is the shortened version. I think it stands for Laser Interferometer Something Observatory. And that's located somewhere in America. And it's basically these two very long arms of a building that are several kilometers long, and each arm has a laser sent down it. And if a gravitational wave is detected, there will be a deviation in one laser but not the other. Or maybe it's both lasers. I'd have to check that. But basically, it's impossible for a deviation to occur in either one or both of these lasers if it's not a gravitational wave occurrence. And it took them years to find something.
And it's not something you can see. You can't tell the laser by eyesight. It's a
microscopic thing. So they have a sensor that does it. So basically, the sonification that they presented, this 5 seconds of kind of hissy noise, was essentially that.
The tiny
of
deviation
in a laser
told scientists reams of information.
Yes. So that one kind of combined more conceptual ideas with the information that they provided. And then I guess the next piece that I'll play was called Nova. And this one, basically, I used supernovas as a really interesting romantic idea. And I collated every supernova that has ever been seen in human history, which is a lot. It starts off about 800 years ago. And
what is a supernova?
That's the death of a star. So it's basically when a star runs out of material and explodes under its own weight and creates a very, very bright object in the sky. So early on, in human history of spotting supernovas. They're not that many, and if they were spotted, they were incredibly huge. So the this visualization that I created basically mapped supernovas by year and by magnitude. So as we move from these initial very sparse but very massive sightings, it gets down to the present day when we have very sensitive telescopes that are trained to see microscopic detail and see very, very faint supernovas from galaxies and galaxies away.
I imagine the first scientist that saw the first supernova or whatever in a primitive telescope or just with their eye, I don't know.
It was sighted in the sky, I think, because this was way before a lot of science. I think it was first spotted in China.
So it must have freaked people out.
Yeah, and I think probably biblical stuff was related to these things, like the star.
The end of the world or something. Yeah,
well, the star of Jesus possibly, because a supernova would stay in the sky for a number of nights. It's amazing because it's such a big event, and obviously a star is alive and has a life cycle that is so huge. But a supernova, that the actual death of this star is only visible for like maybe 3 weeks. It happens, and that's like obviously like a short period in
it cosmic. Dies off quickly, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, because the star lives for thousands and thousands of years, and then 3 weeks, that's pretty quick.
It is. I mean, probably
what does it become?
The process of it dying probably takes a while, and then the collapse of it.
Does it collapse into a black hole?
Or it can collapse into a black hole or a nebula. So some nebulas, I think, are dead stars that have collapsed. Or things like pulsars and neutron stars, which aren't quite black holes, but they're dense balls of matter. So it's the star collapses into itself and it becomes the size of a small city, but it has this huge magnetic pull, which you wouldn't want to be pulled into. I think I saw a program about that and you would just be ripped to shreds very, very quickly. But so it combines this visualization, which I laser cut into metal, and then I distributed through light. And then I had several sonification elements. So I took all the information from the supernova data tables and I cross-modulated it into a CRT screen, which is a television screen, an old television screen. But also it created interesting sounds. So the television's creating its own kind of input. And then there was a more standard sonification, which I created using granular synthesis and these data points that kind of was distributed over 6 speakers in the space. So it was kind of a combination of sound and visual, and it again mixed abstract and more concrete areas. But this one was quite concrete because the visualization was basically like a complex graph.
All right, so we're going to hear that next?
Yes. Thank you.
So next we're going to head to the ringed planet, Saturn?
Yes, and that was kind of my initial inspiration to move on to this project from after working with Turbulent Forms. And my initial idea was that it would be incredibly poetic to somehow create a sonification of Saturn's rings and have that rotating on a turntable. And my initial idea was I wanted to map every, or I like the idea of mapping every object in the ring and having that as a point on a piece of vinyl. And then as the vinyl, as the needle moved around, you'd get these clicks.
Because the rings sort of almost look like a vinyl record in terms of there's imperfections in the, which is what in a record, the grooves have imperfections, and that's the information of the record, right?
Yeah, exactly. So I thought that'd be a really poetic idea. And that's one of the things I'm really kind of keen on, is having these very simple poetic notions and exploring my work through that. But there's so many objects in Saturn's rings. When I began researching it, I found that there's no concise map of all the objects. There's millions and millions of things that are often like very, very tiny.
Too many.
Yeah, I mean, just we don't have cameras or technology that can even sense that. And a lot of the objects in the rings are incredibly tiny in terms of cosmic scale. So it's, you know, like small rocks. And some of the larger objects are about a kilometer. And something I found really fascinating when I was doing this initial research is that the average depth of the rings is only 8 meters. So it's tiny, but because it's so expansive in width, that we can see it. And it's basically because there's light reflecting off it. Some of the moons in the rings create interesting imperfections too. Like, I think one of them was Daphnis, and they create these gaps. So in the sonification, you can actually see these gaps.
Are all the 69 moons in the rings, or are they at different...
A lot of them are outside, but sometimes they orbit through. But the main moons that are orbital of the inner rings, they create these distortions that manifest as waves. So there's a gap where the moon is because it's kind of its gravity is clearing out that space. But there's also these waves that are quite beautiful to look at.
Are the rings sort of like at the equator of Saturn, or are they tilted in one way or the other?
I think they are slightly tilted, but it probably is the equator, and it would be based on... Because it's basically probably its most gravitational strong point. The center. It might look like it's tilted, but that might more be on Saturn's rotation in a lot of the images. But something I'd be fascinated to see in the future would be a full kind of... Even just a full high-quality image of Saturn's rings, because obviously like every image that we're seeing is collated from a lot of different images kind of pasted together. But it would be amazing to have even if it's not like every single object, but a more detailed map of it. Say everything over 50 meters in Saturn's rings would be a really cool resource.
Yes, it's kind of incredible to think of how much mankind has learned in like the last 100 years. And then you think about how much mankind still doesn't know about so many things, space mostly, because we've sent out so few craft even to take pictures or record sound or anything.
Yeah, it's amazing to me as well, like looking at through these data sets, that a lot of it people are asking very simple questions when they go about it. It's not, I often get intimidated by physics thinking it's this huge subject, but a lot of times it's like there's lots of different tools on these crafts to sense different parameters. But a lot of time it's like we want to record the magnetic field of this planet, or we want to do this, we want to test the soil of this planet. And it's simple questions. The complex bit is obviously sending a probe and getting something out of our orbit into the atmosphere, out the atmosphere,
and then actually transmitting the information back too, right?
Yeah, that's insane, especially things like Voyager, which has left our solar system and is still
sending us stuff back, right? Yeah,
I think there was someone, or they were looking for a Fortran programmer who could actually like communicate with the probe, because I think a lot of Fortran programmers are dead or not in the game anymore, and it's got such old legacy code that they need someone using Fortran, maybe an even older language to communicate with it.
And that's got a record, a vinyl record in it too, doesn't it?
It does, and I think that that again links into why I'm interested in representing space through vinyl. That has something called the golden disc, which I think was proposed by Carl Sagan, and it's got all sorts of recordings from Earth. I think it has a lot of people saying hello in different languages, possibly some of our biosphere sounds. I think it also has some music, probably a Mozart or a Beethoven piece.
And a Led Zeppelin song, right?
Okay. Because those are the two representative.
I'm kidding, yes.
And it has a picture of some people. Yeah, it's a neat disc.
And that was 1978 that Voyager left, or am I right?
I'd have to look it up. That's but my guess. It's been a really long time, and that's I think they guess. Only were thinking it would be out for like 10 or so years. And
it's been 30 years or whatever.
Yeah, it's crazy. It's still still moving around.
All right, well, where are we moving to next?
So the next thing I wanted to play is kind of a humorous piece that isn't a piece that I made, but it's a recording of people talking about working with data. And this is someone else who's done a supernova sonification. This is someone from NASA. And it's a BBC television show. And I've just extracted the audio. But it's interesting to hear a scientist talk about how they work with this information. And often I found that scientists use sonification and visualization to kind of talk in a more artistic way about their practice. And often they fall in this space in between where they almost get confused about it. So I find it interesting to see scientists lost for words in how to explain something. And it's an interesting insight into how people are using data in scientific practices.
This is simply just presenting data in a different way. Has it led to people getting other insights into it that hadn't previously occurred?
Exactly. So if you just do some standard, computational models, you don't see some of the variations in the data as the way the light rises and falls, like you were discussing, that you can hear.
We can hear it, actually. Yeah, we can hear, I think, a sample of this. It's surprisingly scary. The sound of a supernova.
The sound of a supernova sneaking up.
It is, yeah. Yeah. Supernova down an alleyway about to attack you.
What's the beat?
There's a dun, it's the radio. Dun, dun,
dun, dun. What's determining the...
So it's always the beat is the time scale on which we take the data. So that...
In my diary last night, I put an excerpt of a TED talk with someone called Lily Asquith, who was talking about some of her sonification stuff at CERN, and she showed a diagram, and it has these arrows that draw between sort of data points and how that's controlling the sound. And she said the science is in these arrows, and I found that was a very funny sentence, which made me laugh. And I feel it makes me feel better because I feel that sometimes I have trouble articulating my ideas. It makes me happy that scientists also have trouble articulating their ideas.
And so what is the next idea you're going to try to articulate here?
I think I'm like close. I didn't like...
We're at the end of our journey?
I think we're at the end of the journey. I could add something else in, but I don't know what I tried to think of things that were...
Well, or just you want to tell us, what did you get out of the week at Wave Farm sort of traversing the solar system?
Yeah, it was really a great experience for me because there's so much time and space to just focus on this project. Also, I came into it with some quite specific ideas, and I was inspired by Wayfarm to kind of explore those ideas in different ways and try new things. So that's always really nice when you get inspired to do something completely different in a way. And that was through the space and also through the library. I did a lot of research every day, and there were things like particular books like the Maria Chavez book about turntablism. Inspired some of the work that I was doing. There was a book by Florian Hecker and his chimerizations that I really liked, and that was more visual. I wasn't actually entirely sure about the text. I couldn't quite understand the meaning, but I know it relates to some sound pieces he's done too. But I found that as a product of work really fascinating.
To stay on the topic of not being able to describe things, right?
Yeah. So I loved that book. And then also the Douglas Kahn book, Sound Earth, Sound Signal, has always been something that I found a great read. And I'm going to have to purchase that when I get back to
Toronto. It's
kind of
a Bible for this sort of philosophy or religion, I guess.
Yeah, it's an amazing book.
All right, so we've been talking with Dan Tapper, who's been exploring the solar system in radio sound this week at Wave Farm. You want to give out your website addresses and the app too?
Sure. So my website is www.dantappersounddesign.com, and I'm going to be having some site-specific geolocative stuff at Wave Farm, which will be accessed through an app called Echoes XYZ. On the App Store, you can just search Echoes, E-C-H-O-E-S. And the sound walk I'm designing for that is called Seven Songs for Seven Planets, Point One.
All right, Dan Tapper, thank you so much for this tour of the solar system in sound and radio sound.
Awesome. Thank you for having me. I've had a great time.
Hello, today is Saturday, July the 7th, and this is my final day as a resident artist at Wayfarm. Today I was able to bring all the work that I've been doing during the course of the residency together and share that work with Wayfarm visitors and broadcast audiences. During this week I've been doing a number of daily audio diaries where I spend a bit of time each day talking about the work that I've been developing for my Wayfarm residency. These catalogued my initial ideas, inspirations, and also talked about how these developed into more finalised and refined works. The work I have been creating this week is called Seven Songs for Seven Planets and A Black Hole at the Heart of the Universe. And this combines physical pieces and digital pieces, performance and conceptual art, as well as text and broadcast. Today I showcased four location-specific installations, a live performance work, and the geolocational sound work on the app Echoes XYZ. The inspiration for these works comes from space and utilizing data from space as a creative tool. Some of these pieces work very closely to this data, and some use it as a jumping off point as a conceptual tool. For my final diary, I'm going to play two of these pieces, and I've based this selection on the ephemeral nature of both of these pieces. The first piece that I want to play is my geolocational-based soundscape work. This piece is only accessible when you are present at the Wayfarm site using GPS data on a smartphone. The work that I have created features a number of overlapping sound areas, allowing the listener to move slowly between these areas as they navigate the Wayfarm site. Some sections are constant throughout the piece, while others can only be accessed at specific points of Wayfarm. To share the work with you, I recorded my own walk around Wayfarm, listening to the soundscapes that are generated. The second piece I'm going to play is a performance work that I did today. And this performance work combined a number of the things that I've been trying out this week. This ranged from the sounds that I was collecting and creating from data from space, to working with prepared turntables and self-built tone arms. Incorporating sounds from the Wavefarm site, as well as using electromagnetic pickups and contact microphones to amplify and reveal tiny unheard sounds. This piece will be the last work I broadcast while a resident at Wavefarm, and I'd like to thank Galen and Tom of Wavefarm for hosting me and supporting the work. I've had a really fantastic time at Wavefarm, and it's triggered a lot of new creative exploration, and I'm really happy with what I've been able to create this week. So thank you so much, I've really enjoyed my time here. Just one quick note as I play this performance. It was recorded using a handheld microphone, so there may be some ambient noise such as wind and people moving around. There are also a couple of moments when the left channel breaks up due to a faulty cable, and this can maybe sound a little bit surprising. This recording is not the full performance, but an excerpt. The full performance was about an hour and 20 minutes, but for the purpose of this broadcast, I've selected my favourite bits and collated them together. Thank you.